Okay, our subject this morning is anima images in the Bible. So we'll proceed as though we didn't have a break. And I hope those of you who were here last fall will remember some of the basic concepts that I put forward about interpreting the Bible from a psychological viewpoint. So it's with that understanding that I proceed into this next section that we're really talking about biblical text. Remember, as though it were a dream, and interpreting the text using Jungian concepts of dream interpretation. So if you find some of these things that I say a little extraordinary, you have to keep that in the back of your mind, that I'm not speaking as a theologian or historian or literary interpreter of the Bible. This is a psychological interpretation. So in dealing with the Bible as a dream or a dream series and taking up our interpretive position as though we were looking at the contents of a dream dreamt over several centuries by a multitude of individuals, we must always keep reminding ourselves that the dream is a reflection of unconscious processes at work in the collective unconscious, particularly a collective dream of this sort. This keeps us from falling, by reminding ourselves in this way that that's what we're doing, we can keep from falling into the concretistic fallacy, as I'd call it, which would have us take the story at its face value and repeat it to ourselves as though it were history. On the other hand, on the one hand, this helps us with the elements of this interpretive stance of being psychological interpreters, helps us with those elements in the Bible that really are clearly and explicitly mythical and metaphorical. In other words, we can do something with them that we would have a great difficulty with if we were treating it as history. You know, the fundamentalists have this problem. On what date was the world actually created, and how many days did it take God, and how do you know, you make a calendar and you try to figure out, interlace that with geology and all of that. I mean, it gets incredibly difficult to treat it as history. Conundrums like, who did Esau marry? Is that it? Or, you know, the Ishmael. Somebody goes out and marries somebody, and there aren't supposed to be any other people around at the time. So you get into all those kinds of problems. So if you have a psychological stance as an interpreter, you have a much easier time with those aspects of the Bible that are clearly mythical and metaphorical, particularly sections of Genesis and the Book of Revelation, the miracles of Jesus, the virgin birth, all those kinds of elements in the Bible that are very difficult to take from a modern scientific historical perspective. But to be consistent, we have to also treat the elements in the Bible that are explicitly historical as dream elements. We're going to treat the whole Bible as a dream, not only the metaphorical or symbolic parts. And so we read history for its symbolic meanings, as though these were emergences from the unconscious. This is also part of the dream. History is the dream. Actually, this isn't so different from treating the Bible as the story of the unfolding of God's plan in history, since that viewpoint, too, that theological viewpoint, interprets history as the concrete expression of an invisible hand at work in the background. This is the way the Bible actually would want us to take it, and it's the way theologians would have us take it. So that it isn't so unusual to treat history in a metaphorical sense or as being an expression of something else. History is an expression of other forces in the background. In a sense, then, we are closer in treating the Bible as a psychological text and viewing the story as we would a dream to the Bible's own self-understanding as the revelation of God's plan in and through history. than are those students of the Bible who treat it as a purely secular historical record, for example. And there are people who do that, archaeologists and so on. There are approaches to the Bible that are purely secular and historical, and that don't pay any attention whatsoever to this notion of the hidden hand at work behind history. From our vantage point, then, as psychological interpreters, we have discerned that the Bible is centrally about a personality whose guiding and controlling inner figure is Yahweh. Yahweh is the personality, or the center of the personality, that's dreaming the dream of the Bible. Yahweh represents the archetypal dominant upon which this story centers. Now, in the course of the story, course of the dream, Yahweh reveals a great deal about his nature, about his personality, his traits, and his characteristics. He becomes a clearly defined personality in the course of the Bible, and in this sense is not so different from the gods of other pantheons, like Zeus or Votan, who also have clearly defined personalities as expressed in the stories and myths about them. But in one great and impressive difference between the Yahwistic mythologem and that of the others that one can think of, like Ray, the sun god Ray of Egypt, or the Greek Zeus, or the Germanic Wotan, is the exclusivity of his presence in the heavenly realms. Yahweh is the only one who exists in heaven, practically speaking. He is the utter master of his kingdom. He doesn't share power with anybody else. There is no pantheon. And others who may exist in and around him are there only by his consent. Servants, such as the angels, or other types of minions in his court, or the souls of people who go to heaven later, and so on.